I refuse to be good. This is a matter of survival, not inclination or mood. I refuse to be easy, and I refuse others' preferences. I refuse to be amicable, and I refuse to appease. I refuse to go along, and I refuse to agree. I refuse to do what I was trained to do. Instead, I choose whatever lies beyond my social conditioning, even if I'm still looking for it, still spurring it into being. This is work of the mind, cerebral and tough. This is work of new language, new concepts, new intonations, and my thinking must expand to fit the scale of all existence.
'Cause it's hard to be a person with a body these days when bonkers TikTok diets are all the rage. And why are the seats so damn small on the airplane? 'Cause it's hard to be a person with a body these days.
You are listening to Burnt Toast. I'm Virginia Soul Smith. Today, my conversation is with the brilliant Savala Nolan. Savala is a writer, public speaker, and professor at UC Berkeley. Her brand new book, Good Woman, A Reckoning, comes out this week. Her first book, Don't Let It Get You Down, Essays on Race, Gender, and the Body, was celebrated as a standout collection by the New York Times. Savala's writing has been featured in Vogue, Harper's Magazine, and the New York Times, NPR, Time, and more. I have a lot of conversations about bodies. I have a lot of conversation about gender. There is a lot that I thought I knew about race and bodies and gender in America. And reading Good Woman and talking to Savala blew my mind apart in ways that I'm still putting back together. This conversation is a must listen. This book is a must read. There was so much good stuff in this conversation. We are breaking it up into two episodes. Today, we're talking about bodies, race, and gender. Savala Part 2 will drop in 2 weeks, and that's when we're getting into sex, divorce, and Savala's classy and trashy betters. That conversation will be for paid subscribers only, so go to patreon.com/VirginiaSoulSmith to join us. Membership starts at just $5 a month, and you are not going to want to miss this one. One last thing. Trust me, you will want to read Good Women after hearing this conversation. And if you order it from my local independent bookstore, Split Rock Books, you can take 10% off your copy if you have also ordered a copy of my book, Fat Talk, from them. So go to splitrockbks.com and use the code FATTALK at checkout. Now here's Savala. So why don't we just start by having you tell listeners a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Sure. I'm a writer. I was thinking about this question quite a bit, actually, because my very first instinct is to say I'm a mom, you know, which makes perfect sense. Yep. Motherhood is all consuming. But I thought I'll start with something that doesn't include my relationship with another human being, just in the interest of practicing my own wholeness. So I'm a writer and a mom and a lawyer. I direct the social justice program at UC Berkeley's law school, which is really a privilege and gives me a lot of hope because I get to see hundreds of law students every day who want to change the world, make it better. I'm also a former dieter, like a hardcore former dieter, which is what initially brought me kind of into your world and your work. I was put on my first diet when I was like 2 or 3. And rode those waves up and down until I was maybe 36 or 37. So I've got a few decades under my belt. And I include that in my sort of mini biography because that experience of going on and off diets for so long and of being, I mean, almost like pre-verbal when I was sort of indoctrinated into that world of dieting informs a lot of what I do, including as a mom, including as a lawyer, including as a writer. Body liberation and gender and race, they fascinate me endlessly, how they play together and kind of co-create each other in most of what I write about, and definitely what I write about in Good Woman, my new book, stems from that experience of dieting and then breaking free from dieting in my 30s.
That is like the best intro I think anyone's ever given themselves on the podcast.
Oh, stop.
No, really. I love that you are like, let me own this part of my story. This is the origin point. And then now let's get into the conversation. That's fantastic. So yes, we are here to talk about your exquisite new book, Good Women, A Reckoning. It is a collection of 12 essays about what it means to be a woman. It's this incredible blend of memoir, reporting, history. I would love you to read us the first paragraph just to set the stage for everything we're going to talk about.
I'll just take a quick second to set it up a little bit before I read the first paragraph in the book from the very first chapter. I'm trying to take a critical and very skeptical eye to all the ways that women and girls are socialized to be good, almost from birth, right? In our particular culture, good means agreeable, quiet, sort of serving of others, all the things that probably would pop into any woman's head when she hears the idea of a good woman or a good girl. So I'm trying to unpack and destroy some of that socialization in my own life and think about what lies beyond it. So to kick the book off, there's this very short essay that's sort of a manifesto. I think of it as like a huge bell that rings to kind of open the book. Here's the first paragraph. I refuse to be good. This is a matter of survival, not inclination or mood. I refuse to be easy, and I refuse others' preferences. I refuse to be amicable, and I refuse to appease. I refuse to go along, and I refuse to agree. I refuse to do what I was trained to do. Instead, I choose whatever lies beyond my social conditioning, even if I'm still looking for it, still spurring it into being. This is work of the mind, cerebral and tough. This is work of new language, new concepts, new intonations, and my thinking must expand to fit the scale of all existence. It is also body work, work that is nailed to my flesh. It is gestating of new bones and anointing of muscle and fat. It is passing through the stomatous black opening of my own cervix to the bright field waiting on the other side in the wilderness. It is a lot to take on, but I welcome the challenge and the mystery and the darkness. It was in darkness that the universe was made. It is in darkness that each day is made new.
Oh, thank you. That was incredible. Really, it was.
Thank you.
I loved how you opened the book because it encapsulates so many of the themes that you then go deeper in every chapter. One of the biggest themes of refusal in the book is around the body. And you write about how Black women's bodies in particular are just constrained, controlled, and made not their own. And I really, really want people to read this because we don't have time to talk about all the history you go through. And it's so well done. You trace this narrative from Sarah Bartman and Sally Hemings all the way to Nicki Minaj, connecting so many dots, and it's really powerful. What has changed and what hasn't changed when it comes to how Blackness and fatness are policed for women?
I love this question. We could probably write a doctoral thesis,
yes,
you know, or dissertation on this question alone.
Yes.
So I'll just sort of share what comes to mind as sort of smorgasbord of thoughts that come to mind when you ask this question. So the first thing is there's an overlap when we talk about Blackness and fatness in this culture. I guess the very first point to make is that everything here is cultural.
Mm-hmm.
Not all cultures treat women's bodies, Blackness and fatness the way we do. So that's sort of the page on which everything else is written. But it's interesting to me when we talk about Blackness and fatness, like the stereotypes overlap,
mm-hmm,
right? Both fat people and Black people are sort of viewed in this culture as out of control, lazy, kind of greedy, like having a hyper appetite, either being hypersexualized or desexualized, you know? So you either have the kind of va 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 voom, or, you know, the friend, never the leading lady when it comes to fatness. And with blackness, it's the same thing. You either have the kind of what you might, in a more generous way of thinking, call the video vixen, right? This kind of hypersexual black woman in a music video, or kind of the mammy, right? So it's interesting to me that the stereotypes overlap so much. And maybe the most powerful way they overlap is that they're both undesirable. Like, they're both things in our culture that you should try to get away from if you can. You should try not to be too black or too fat in our culture. So to me, as a woman who's fat and black, it's kind of a 1-2 punch. And they work together. Just the stereotypes alone overlapping tells you that there's some relationship in our culture between these two things. And as you say, it goes way, 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 way back. In this country, it goes to chattel slavery, where blackness and fatness started to be sort of policed together and associated together very literally. I talk about this in the book, but off the top of my head, there's a magazine called Godey's Ladies Book, which you might consider kind of the Vogue or slash Good Housekeeping of today. You know, it's sort of like fashion, but also like homey stuff. And it was the biggest magazine in the antebellum country. And they talked all the time about how white women should stay thin or else they might start to be black. Like, they might start to be looked on as if they're black.
Yeah.
There's another article from that magazine that says, if a white woman gets fat, she might as well put herself in blackface. So, I know. Well, there's an eye roll. If you can't see it if you're listening, but there's a lovely eye roll from Virginia. And so our culture has long braided these things together. And that's kind of the history. When you think about what hasn't changed, I think they are still braided together. When we think about what has changed, from my vantage point, there was maybe, oh, I don't know, 5 years. Maybe 10 years, maybe, where it felt more okay to be fat and more okay to be black. It was kind of the, like, ascendance of Lizzo, you know?
A brief shining moment.
It was a shining moment. And there was also, you know, the George Floyd moment. There was a sort of political reckoning with blackness that was refreshing. I guess maybe it wasn't even 5 years. There was a brief window.
Yeah.
And now it feels like we're in a backlash. So it feels a little bit like the more things change, the more they stay the same. We had this moment of, I think, a collective kind of leap towards something like liberation. And I think because of politics and because of the capitalistic nature of the pharmaceutical industry in this country and GLP-1s being so, for now anyway, profitable, we're seeing a real backlash to both fatness and blackness. And that lands on women really hard because of how women are sort of tied to our bodies in this culture in a particular way. So I guess I would say the more things change, the more they stay the same. The silver lining being that because we did have these few years of something like enlightenment, you know, the kind of like first sun rays coming over the mountain, there are a lot of people who have a much higher capacity to talk about what our culture does to fatness and blackness.
Yes, I agree with that.
Than there were, say, 20 years ago.
For sure.
Right?
For sure. Yeah.
So that's a silver lining, I think.
And we see these moments of women claiming their bodies and claiming control over their bodies and then facing tremendous backlash. I mean, you talk about the Nicki Minaj album cover that she was like taken to task for, you know, being too sexual, too graphic, et cetera. And she's like, it's my body.
It's my body. And also, it's no worse than a Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue.
Right.
And everybody likes those.
Yes, they sure do. But those are skinny white bodies.
Those are skinny white ladies, not voluptuous black women.
But there are these moments where we have the conversation, whereas she wouldn't have had the album cover. We wouldn't have had the conversation. But I'm with you on, like, it's not enough. The backlash feels so brutal right now, but I do hang on to those moments.
I do as well. And I think the comfort of a backlash is that you know you were doing something right.
Yeah.
You can't make a quilt with one stitch. You have to put a lot of stitches in.
Yeah.
And so we have to keep stitching as far as our own liberation goes. And the backlashes will come periodically. The tide comes in and out. You just try to keep inching it forward. So I'm hopeful that we will continue ultimately to do that.
And keep reminding people where we've been. I really appreciated your post on Instagram this week. You know, there's been so much talk about ICE as the Gestapo. And you were like, guys, it's not the Gestapo. It's slave patrols. Like, it's our own country. It's our own history that's coming up again here. As where I should note for listeners, you're going to be hearing this in March, but we're recording this at the end of January, right after all of the violence and murders in Minneapolis.
I understand the urge to look to other countries and the violence in other places. And it's Gestapo-like, you know.
Sure is.
It's certainly fair to think about a comparison. But to completely ignore the fact that we actually invented this stuff.
the Gestapo guys kind of learned it from us.
100%. Exactly.
They've been watching what America was doing.
Yes. And I think it's sad to own it, but it's a necessary step in managing it and moving beyond it is to really hold it close and see that it's our own stuff. It's just like an individual, right? Like an individual who wants to grow and improve. They have to own their shit. Oh, this is my shit. I have to work on it.
Right.
It's the same. It's just at the level of culture.
Yes. As a country, we have to own our shit. And some of us are doing more of that than others. Well, on the level of the individual, you write a lot in the book about, as you already talked about, growing up as a fat little girl, being put on diets so heartbreakingly early, and then continuing to pursue thinness throughout college, early adulthood. Now that you're on the other side of that, you write about how abandoning the pursuit of thinness feels like becoming a non-woman. And I really was interested in this idea of the non-woman. I would love to talk about that a little.
You know, there's a quote I love from a scholar, Sandra Gilman, who studies fatness and gender. You might know this quote, Virginia. Some of your listeners might too, where he writes that dieting is a way that women show they understand their role in society. Part of the way that women remain and become legible in our culture is by practicing and performing privately and publicly dissatisfaction with their bodies. And the pursuit of a better body, which generally means a thinner body or a more toned body or a, quote, healthier body. When you do those things as a woman, people get it. They understand you. They don't have to make any inferences. They don't have to wonder what you're doing. It's instantly obvious. And when I talk about how much people rely on that sort of vocabulary to understand women. When I do this, when I talk publicly at, you know, schools and stuff about this, one of the first things I do in my talks is post a before and after photo without the words before and after.
Oh.
And I ask people to raise their hands if they know what it is. And the room could have 300 people in it. Everybody raises their hands. And they raise it because you know exactly what you're seeing. That's what I mean when I say the performance of dieting or body improvement or body shame publicly and also privately makes you readable as a woman to the culture. People can literally read it instantly, the way you can read a stop sign.
Mm-hmm.
When you stop doing that, when you stop dieting, exercising in ways that are meant to control the shape of your body, the weight of your body, all that stuff. When you stop using that vocabulary to bond with other women, when you stop policing what other people eat, when you stop doing those things, people don't get it. There's some level on which you're no longer performing the role of a woman, right? That's what I mean when I say you kind of become a non-woman. You become this other entity that, you know, let's be clear, exists in other cultures, has existed in this culture to some extent in various pockets of it. But that's what I mean. It's like you step outside of the mold and then people aren't quite sure what to do with you. Can I give a quick example?
Yeah, please.
I work with a fabulous team of people I love and adore at UC Berkeley. One of them had a birthday. So to celebrate, I brought in a box of fabulous French pastries. We had a little birthday party. And we invited lots of people to come by and pick something up if they wanted to. Every person who came in the room said something, and they all happened to be women, something like, ooh, I worked out this morning. That's how I earned this.
Yes.
Right? Some version of that. Oh, God, I shouldn't. I had a bagel for breakfast. Or I'm going to cut it in half because I think I'm going to have a big dinner tonight.
Oh, my Lord.
I was the only one who didn't. And at some point, I said, come on, guys, let's just let the food be food. We don't have to earn our food here.
You don't actually have to publicly perform.
And you could have heard a pin drop, Virginia.
Oh, I'm sure.
It was like, oh, I just said something in a different language. People don't know how to read the moment anymore.
Yeah.
They don't know how to read me anymore. It's so disruptive. So that's what I mean about becoming the non-woman. In that essay, I then go on to talk about the joy of being a non-woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean this in the sense of gender identity. I mean it in a more metaphorical, philosophical way. You know, I very much identify as a woman.
Right, right. But you're rejecting these expectations and this narrow definition of womanhood.
100%. 100%. And it's a little experiment. If listeners want to try that, you know, I'm sure most of your listeners are already at least 1 foot in the door of kind of not dieting anymore.
Yeah.
But if they want to try performing something else and seeing how they become no longer instantly readable in the space, they'll know what I mean.
It's interesting because it's about you kind of simultaneously become more visible because you're doing this uncomfortable thing no one knows what to do with. Mm. And you're rendering yourself more invisible because you're no longer saying like, yes, you can identify me as a sex object. Yes, you can identify me as young and thin and pretty and all the, you know, so then it's like, oh, we don't know what to do with her.
Totally. It's a spotlight. It's a spotlight for sure. It's like, what's that?
Yep.
You know, there's some rubbernecking that happens and you can be in the mood to deal with it or not. You know, it's not like I always will say something when I'm around little pockets of diet culture.
Right.
But in that moment, there were like, I don't know, 12 or 15 people who came through and it was like every single one. Well, oh,
can
my
we
Lord.
Not just eat the pastries? Yeah.
Yeah. And if you don't want one for whatever reason, that's okay.
Don't tell us why. Just don't eat it. It's fine.
Just don't eat it.
Well, that's a great example, too, because that's also the kind of modeling that I'm sure you're conscious of doing in front of your kiddo. There's a line in the book I really loved where you said, my child is my child, carrier of my histories, and I worry she'll be particularly vulnerable to dieting. In order to fortify her, I build a home life free from diet culture. This is, of course, like a huge focus of my work, why I wrote Fat Talk.
It's the bread and butter, if you will.
It is the bread, yes. We'll get to the butter. But it's definitely the foundation of Burnt Toast. And yeah, I often deliberately, I'm more likely to say the thing about let's just eat the cake or eat the dessert when I know my kids are listening because it's like I got to model the other way. I got to model the non-woman for them right now. I would love to know what are some of your favorite, like, little things you do to get the anti-diet parenting stuff in?
Well, the number one thing, and this will be very familiar, I think, to the Burnt Toast crew, is I myself don't diet, right? That's number one.
Yeah.
I don't pursue intentional weight loss, and I haven't since my daughter was about 6 months old. That was my sort of breaking point when I started to look for a different kind of life. Not only do I not diet or pursue intentional weight loss, I never, not once, have ever spoken ill of my body or complained about my body in front of my daughter. It's funny when you're raising a girl, because on the one hand, I want my daughter to feel beautiful and I want to speak a sense of beauty into her. Oh, you're so beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk about myself through the lens of beauty for that reason, too. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you don't want to overemphasize beauty and sort of teach them that that is a super meaningful currency that they have to, you know what I mean?
It's like, you are beautiful and it's the least interesting thing about you. Like that always has to be, you're holding both of those with both hands all the time.
All the time, all the time. So I speak well of my body, but, you know, try not to do it in a way that feels too cover of a magazine oriented. Mm-hmm. There's other little things, like we decant food in our house, so most of it is not associated with quote-unquote nutrition information. Mm. And we talk about nutrition information because she picks it up in the world.
Sure.
But in our house, it's just in the container. I make a point of letting her choose how much she eats. I tend to take on the responsibility of picking what's on offer, and then she chooses how much. Mm-hmm. But we mix that up as she's gotten older. I fill my home with media, physical media, like figurines, statues, posters, books that have all kinds of bodies, especially fat bodies, because I want that to feel normal and celebrated for her. Like, I want her to see fat bodies depicted as beautiful, wonderful things, not just as things we try to move away from or punish. It's good for me, too. So almost anything that I practice for myself, I practice for her in kind of an age-appropriate way, including sometimes really playfully. Like, it doesn't all have to be political, you know. I talk in the book about this one episode that my daughter, where she was probably about 4 or 5 years old, and she wanted some chocolate chips after she had already had dessert. And so initially I was like, no, you know, you had your ice cream. We'll have chocolate chips another time. And then I was like, I want some chocolate chips. I said, actually, yeah, let's have some chocolate chips. So, you know, we each had a little handful. And she said, I wish I could have more. And I was like, I think one is enough. And then I was like, actually, let's have more. And we sort of did that playfully a few times. And she still loves it. She just remembers it with such joy. My goal there was to have a little fun, but also to like celebrate appetite and take this moment that we often are taught to read as sort of personal failure, right? Going back for a little more and change it into something that was just fun and goofy and totally fine.
And like celebrating pleasure. Yeah, let's have more. Yeah. They taste good tonight. Let's do it. And not put guardrails around that.
Exactly. And so I look for moments like that. And I'll say this, who knows what the future brings, but my kid has a really joyful, non-self-conscious relationship with food that involves eating all kinds of things, including broccoli and kale, and with her body. So who knows what the world brings, right? We do know what the world brings.
We know what's coming, yes.
We know what's coming, but she has a foundation that's much better than mine was, that's for sure.
Yeah, such a different foundation than what you had, and that has to do something. I have to believe that.
It has to. And I must say, obviously, your book inspires me and was part of my inspiration in how I approached feeding my kiddo.
I'm so glad it's helpful, yeah. I mean, it's always a work in progress, but it is really rewarding when you see kids having that ease and not overthinking and not getting caught in those traps that we did, for sure.
100%.
Yeah. All right. Well, this was an amazing conversation. Thank you so much for being here. Just tell folks where we find you, how we support your work.
Oh, it's been a serious joy to be here. I could do it all again. The best way to support my work is, of course, to buy Good Woman a Reckoning and share it with the women in your life that you love, and maybe even the men in your life that you love.
I agree with that.
Yeah. And if you can't buy it, you know, you can get it at libraries or borrow it from a friend. Obviously, as an author, I'm interested in book sales, but mostly I'm interested in the ideas in the book, doing good in the world. So read Good Woman. And if people want to hang out a little bit, I'm on Instagram at Savala Nolan, and SavalaNolan.com is my website, which is another way to get in touch with me. And I totally welcome that. I love doing book clubs, talking to readers, all that stuff. So if folks are interested, they should reach out.
Thank you, Savala. This was such a joy.
Thank you, Virginia. The pleasure was mine.
Thanks for listening to Burnt Toast. If you enjoyed the conversation, please support our work with a paid subscription. They start at just $5 a month, and they keep Burnt Toast an ad and sponsor-free space. You can learn more at patreon.com/VirginiaSoulSmith/join. The Burnt Toast podcast is hosted by Virginia Soul Smith and Corinne Fay. Our producer is Kim Baldwin. You can follow me on Instagram at @V_SoulSmith. You can follow Corinne at @SelfieFay and subscribe to Big Undies at patreon.com/BigUndies. You can follow Kim at The Blonde Mule on all platforms and subscribe to The Blonde Mule newsletter at theblondemule.com. The Burnt Toast logo is by Deanna Lowe. Our theme music is by Faraday. Our video editor is Elizabeth Ayiku, who also runs the Me Little Me Foundation, a virtual food pantry supporting multiply marginalized folks recovering from eating disorders. Learn more and donate at MeLittleMeFoundation.org. And Tommy Heron is our audio engineer. Thanks for listening and supporting anti-diet, body liberation, journalism.